the UCR Podcast.
What a thrill it is to be able to welcome David Gilmore back to the podcast. David was our first guest nearly a year ago when we launched the podcast, and there's been a good amount of things that have happened since then. On that list, hopefully you got a chance to see one of the tour dates on his outing in support of Luck and Strange. As you might know, it was a limited run here in the States with a series of shows in Los Angeles, followed by a set of dates at Madison Square Garden in New York City. The good news is, if you missed the chance to see those gigs, David has, of course, documented the experience with a new concert film recorded live in Rome at Circus Maximus, and there is also a new live release called The Luck and Strange Concerts, featuring 23 tracks recorded at different concerts besides the Rome recordings. The film has been screening in cinema locations all over the world in the past week, and you're going to be able to bring it home starting October 17th, and the new live set will be available in a variety of configurations on 4 LPs, 2 CDs, 2 Blu-rays, 3 DVDs, and there is also a big box set that has everything. You can find all sorts of details at davidgilmore.com. We dig into a number of topics in this new chat, including surprising moments like fans who are still hearing music from albums like Dark Side of the Moon for the first time, as well as how he put the show's set list together, his thoughts on the beautiful and historic venue in Rome, why it is that going back to the days of Pink Floyd, the visuals have always been so important to the concerts that he presents, an update on his next studio album that he's got in the planning stages, plus we dig into the story behind how he and Pink Floyd ended up playing songs in concert from Wish You Were Here and Animals before those albums were even out back in the day. It's Matt Wardlaw, and if this is your first time hearing our podcast, thanks for being here. Hit the follow button so you will get further episodes as we put them out. And spoiler alert, we're actually probably going to have a second episode for this week coming sometime tomorrow. As a bonus for today's podcast, if you missed our 2024 conversation with David, we're including that here so you can hear both of our chats with David back to back. If you're looking to fill in some gaps in your musical collection, we have you covered there too with a selection of vinyl from both David and Pink Floyd. Check it out at ucrmerch.com. Use my code WARDLAW15, that is WARDLAW15, to get a 15% discount off your order. Again, that code is WARDLAW15. And if you're looking for some good reading as you listen, make sure to visit ultimateclassicrock.com, where we've written a ton about David and Pink Floyd over the years. Here's our conversation with David Gilmore. We hope you enjoy it.
Hi, David. Okay.
Hi, Matt. How you doing?
I'm doing so good. I am so happy that you documented this latest run of shows, because what a special tour it was. And Circus Maximus, what an amazing place to film that, David.
It is a glorious, beautiful building, you know, built nearly, I think, 2,000 years ago for chariot racing and that sort of stuff. I played there, I think, in 2016, but just one night then. But this was, it sort of gives an indefinable magic to what you're doing. It wraps an atmosphere around, you know, the main event, which is the music. And these days with drones and the footage they are getting, and it's lovely. I'm very keen on that place and places of that are unusual and interesting and have a sense of time about them.
I saw the first night at Madison Square Garden, David, and you know, one of the cool things that I really enjoyed was I had these two gentlemen next to me that I would say were probably in their 50s. And as you got into the second set, you played Sorrow, but then you did The Piper's Call, A Great Day for Freedom, In Any Tongue, and The Great Gig in the Sky. And after those four songs, David, the guy says to his friend, if all of those songs are from David's new album, that new album is pretty good. And like, that was, I think that's a pretty cool commentary on the consistency of the music that you've done over the years. But if you happen to be sitting next to two people like that, perhaps at, like, say, a playback of this new film, like, what would you be thinking? Like, how do you react as the artist hearing a thought like that?
Well, I mean, they're not all new songs.
No.
The four you mentioned, what was it? Piper's Call.
Great Gig in the Sky. I mean, Dark Side of the Moon, you know, like.
Dark Side of the Moon. Yeah. Great Day for Freedom from Division Bell and in it done from like not like strange the Rattle That Lock, yeah,
right
thing. Yeah, wow. Well, you know, that is a lovely little set of songs from a long career. I'm so lucky and grateful to be able to play and perform those songs for people. you know, along with wanting them to hear all my new music.
Yeah, absolutely. And when we spoke last year, you were still in the early stages of figuring out what the set list might look like. And it ultimately had such an interesting flow and such a specific focus as far as the song selection and eras. Like, I know you put a lot of thought into this stuff. And for example, your solo stuff, it was like material from the latest record, the whole record, and also stuff from Rattle That Lock. Like, overall, like, what's the narrative that you really kind of established in your mind as far as the set list you ultimately put across with these shows?
Well, I'm starting from the viewpoint that my ambition, my desire in all this is to do new music. That's what I want to do more than anything else. And obviously, I don't want to ignore the fact that there's quite a large amount of people in that audience who want to hear the things that they know from a long time ago. I love playing all those older songs, but achieving a balance is difficult, I can tell you. Luckily, my lovely wife, Polly, did most of the hard work on putting that set list together.
Yeah, and, you know, when I mentioned those two fans, like, it's interesting to me that there are still people who are hearing something like The Great Gig in the Sky for the first time more than 50 years on. Like, it's got to be interesting to you, whether it is new music or stuff like that that goes way back, how your music continues to find new ears in ways that are sometimes unexpected, right? Like, that's got to be interesting for you, like, to witness.
That's fantastic that someone is at my concert who's that age, who hasn't listened to Dark Side of the Moon 100 times. It's kind of odd, but I'm very grateful for new fans and new people coming to hear. And if they can't really tell the difference, you know, qualitatively between what I'm doing now that's new and things that are ancient as time, then how could I not be happy about that?
Another thing that I think people really appreciated was that with it being the 30th anniversary of the Division Bell record, like, you had four songs from the record in that set, and it had to be thrilling for you to revisit, you know, stuff like Marooned and, you know, we mentioned A Great Day for Freedom with this band. And I would guess that moments like that generate a variety of feelings for you. Like, just generally, what were some of your takeaways from these shows, or perhaps even what was your experience getting to relive what you've done with this latest chapter as you went back and looked at the tour recordings and watched this new film?
Having another go, you know, with different people at recreating and updating some of those songs, you know, tunes. And Maroon, we didn't do that much back in the day, but it's a lovely piece of music that Rick mostly came up with, and we played quite a lot of times, but not that many times. It's lovely to do that. It's lovely to do a Great Day for Freedom, a song which, along with In Any Tongue, both are very relevant in today's political atmosphere around the world. And it's exciting and moving to play those things at this moment in time and with these new musicians who bring something different to it, because it feels like they're freer to express themselves and bring something of themselves to these and all the other songs, rather than the possibly stricter confines of where one might have in the past felt that one ought to hold things.
Yeah, it finds, like, in that way, like, when you're working with a new band and so on, I mean, like, the Webb Sisters, what a treasure, and, you know, seeing you with Romani and so on, like, it just feels like each time you do shows like this, you have new opportunities to discover new things about your music and new layers that probably feed back in a helpful way to your own creative process as you continue to make new music.
That's right. The Webb Sisters, I saw, heard many times. I'm a big Leonard Cohen fan, went to see his last few tours, and the Webb Sisters were on, and Louise Marshall, a beautiful singer who did the whole of my last tour back then. They are such a great section, and bringing Romani into it, added a whole new layer of vocal togetherness of the genetic family harmony thing, and her youthful exuberance, which was feeding into what all the other people, not just the singing ones, you know, not just the vocalists, I mean, who, it has to be said, are also instrumentalists as well, adding invaluable extra parts to the whole proceedings. The four of them have now formed their own little band. Shouldn't say little. They have formed their own band and are out doing shows in England, in London. And they did four nights recently, all sold out in a small club in Smithfield in London. And they've got some more shows coming up where they accompany themselves. And, you know, they're fabulous.
Yeah, it was cool. Like, if we think about you and the band in the same context as, like, you know, the way it was with Pink Floyd, like, it was just cool watching the way all of you just were feeding off of each other at any given moment throughout the show. Like, there was a real enthusiasm and just chemistry that you could feel in the air and just see on the stage.
To be able to feel that chemistry and to note it and to use it is part of what was such a thrill about this one. Because these guys are truly great. They really know their stuff. They play beautifully. And there's a sense of freedom and exploration that is rare in these sort of things.
We talked about the visuals early on, and the show is always such a visual experience. And that made me think, like, obviously that goes way back with you, obviously, in the Pink Floyd times. And I can imagine that at that time, it would have been difficult to mount some of the things that you did back then from a technology standpoint. As a guy that was part of all that, why were the visuals such an important element of the musical experience? Because you can't imagine what you did with Pink Floyd and what you're doing now without it. But, like, why was that so important?
Well, you know, the scale of what music, rock and roll music, whatever you want to call it, is in this day and age. You know, you cannot expect people to sit way back in a seat and not give them something else for their eyes, you know, because just looking at dots on the stage, you can have the screens, you know, that have the on-stage cameras, which are accentuating the musical moments that are going on, but have beautiful lights and video films, which are all accentuating what's going on in the lyric of the song, that therefore it makes it fit the size better.
Yeah, and something else that just was pretty stunning, as many times as I've heard it, was like just like kind of the almost like closing moments where we hear Comfortably Numb. And that, obviously, as you know, is a song that is near and dear to so many people. And if you listen to the audio throughout the nights of this last run of shows, like your solo and other elements kind of like morph and expand and contract depending on which night we're talking about. Like, what do you think it is about that song? Because that's a song that has resonance with you, but obviously has song it resonance with so many people too.
There's a magic that just sometimes happens, you know, and if I knew what the recipe was, I'd cook it more often. You know, I played that tune at Bob Ezrin's Persuasion to the other guys who all liked it, and Roger went away and wrote the words, and it has become something that I cannot fully understand why it has taken on its own life in that way. It's a great title, of course, and the music is memorable. And it's a lovely, easy chord sequence to play over, I can tell you that. That's part of the fun.
Well, as far as the new album, like, where are things kind of with that? Because I know that, like, you've focused some energies on it here in the new year.
Well, I'm working on it. I can't make promises about quite when I can will be ready to put it out there, but it's a slow, hard process, you know, a lot of adding and taking away and trying out and discarding or reshaping. And yeah, that's, you know, the idea of the Beatles doing their first album in one day, basically the guy say tapes roll and they go 1, 2, 3, 4. And that's that one done. Part of me still wishes that it was easier to get to that, but we've all become used to another way of working where you can spend months adding things, taking things away, reshaping, you know, trying different lyrical ideas out, reshaping those so that everything feels like it's been taken to its end point.
And that brings up something else creatively. The announcement of this new Wish You Were Here box set brought me back to some live recordings leading up to that period. For example, the 1974 show at Wembley. At the time, you guys were playing three new songs that were unreleased at that point. An early version of Shine On You Crazy Diamond. A couple songs that fans wouldn't hear in their final form for a few years until they got to Animals. Raving and Drooling, and then You've Got to Be Crazy, you know, which became Sheep and Dogs, respectively. So just generally, I wondered, like, what did that bring to your process playing songs live like that? How much did that help them kind of evolve when you did things like that as a songwriter?
Well, you know, those songs came together in a tiny rehearsal room. Those three songs, Shine On, You Gotta Be Crazy and Raving and Drooling. And if you expect me to remember too much about the processes, however many years later we are, I can't really help you. I mean, I obviously have a lot of memories about those things, but Roger wanted to put Shine On, divide it into two and make it the centerpiece of that next album. And I was really slightly unwilling at the beginning, but you know, these things are commonplace, these little arguments, but he was right. And we carried on with that. And the other two made it onto Animals in due course, a couple of years later.
Here's where I'll leave it. And what's interesting to me about that is just like kind of like the length of time with the creative process, which that happens with songs sometimes. And we saw it as an example with those three songs, but like we've seen it more recently with the music that you've been working on, where it's like you're drawing on things that you recorded at the Barn Jam. So it's just there's a through line there. So it's just an interesting part of your process as a writer.
Yeah, it is indeed, you know. I store everything like a magpie. I store it away somewhere and forget about it. And sometimes I'm playing through old files and I find something that haven't heard for years. And these things always have a way of sparking you off and thinking again about something that you may not have quite managed to get finished yet, and spark you into a new interest in finding out where they could go and how good they really can be. And yeah, a lot of time is spent doing that.
Well, David, congrats on this new film and album. And we, of course, will look forward to hearing the further new music when we get there, because Luck and Strange was such a gift. But thank you for the gift of this time. Always great talking music with you.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot, Matt.
Take care.
Cheers.
Hi, Matt.
How are you, David?
I'm pretty good, really, all things considered.
Where I want to start, like so many of your albums, there are a lot of magical seeds that seem like they helped to form this new record. And I got to hear the bonus tracks. So talking about Luck and Strange, like I wanted to start by talking about the Barn Jams that happened back in January of 2007. What was kind of the impetus for those original Barn Jams?
Well, it was really that we were on tour, doing the On an Island tour. When we got to the end of that tour, I was thinking it's kind of feels like it's a waste for these guys who are cooking and hot. You know, they're really, we're really in a groove together, playing really, really well. And so I thought it was a waste not to do something else with that cohesiveness that we had. So I got the core of the band, you know, Rick, me, Guy, and Steve DeStanislau, to go to my house into a barn. Of course, there were things that hadn't occurred to me was that it was January and the barns, the boards don't even meet, and there's howling icy winds blowing through it, and it's about 5 degrees below zero. But we managed anyway. That was the plan. We did that. There are still 30 or 40 other bits of music, but that one was the first morning. That was the first thing we did. I had that little piece of guitar. I just played bang, bang, bang. I was just listening to that happening, listening to myself playing that and thinking, that's quite nice. And they all gradually, one by one, joined in. And then we played it for 20 minutes or whatever it is. And that is the track. That, I mean, you know, obviously we've worked on it a bit. We've added bridges, middle eights, choruses, but no rehearsal, no second take. It is that is the take. And they joined in so naturally. Anyway, yeah, that's so that all came out of that moment.
And it's so cool. Like, we're heading towards nearly 20 years when you did that in 2007. Like, what brought you back to that particular piece of music that, as you just laid out, became the initial skeleton for the song on this record?
It's very hard to know or to be able to explain why some pieces of music put their hand up and insist that now is their moment. And I can't explain it, really, because that one, I mean, I had it in that basic form with the choruses and the bridges before I did the Rattle That Lock album. But for some reason, it didn't raise its hand and say, do me. And this time it did. And I work a little bit that way. I have on the song called Sings, there's a sample of me, which I recorded me writing the chorus thing for that song in 1997 when my son was two. You can hear him going, sing, daddy, sing. And he's now nearly 30.
Wow.
So, you know, and that was a chorus of a song, and that I tied together with another piece of music that I wrote maybe 6 or 7 years ago. There's a lot of chance and a lot of accidents that happen on the way to this thing creating the form, taking the form that it did.
You said in an interview talking about this record that, as you put it, you've got over 1,000 little tunes and stuff that are all cataloged. When did you first get your arms around getting all that organized, and like, how did you do it? Because that seems like that would have been an interesting process.
To be honest, I've got lots of pieces of music going back into the 80s of this, that, and the other. I've got some whole songs, I've got some newer ones that I've done, and I've got my trusty iPhone. But I have recorded over a thousand tiny bits of something. I mean, it might just be a sound of a bird singing, but I haven't actually really been through those yet. But one of these days I will, or I think I will, when I need something. It sounds like a hell of a lot, but to be honest, you play through them and sort of 19 out of 20, you say that can go straight in the bin.
That's fantastic. And you've spoken about the, as you put it, strange avant-garde nature of the choral arrangements on some of this album. And you have always been, in my view, somebody who has often enjoyed going against the grain over the years with your work. And it seems like things like the interesting approach to those choral arrangements on this new album kind of continue that. Like, I love the way something that potentially shouldn't work works when it's in context with the rest of the music.
Well, exactly that. I mean, I can't put it better, really. I mean, those arrangements are just glorious and are, as you say, very, very unusual. He did these wonderful arrangements, and he did those choirs. But before he did recorded the choirs properly, which we did twice, once in a cathedral called Ely Cathedral and once in a studio in London called Angel Studio. But before then, he had recorded a demo version of it, I think him and his girlfriend, and we put it on the track,
And we grew to love it so much that in the end, what's on the record is as much his demo of it as it is the actual properly written and recorded choir.
I think there can sometimes be trepidation. It sometimes takes some time before you know what the record is going to be as a whole piece, as a whole piece of work. Like, you being somebody who still thinks in terms of the album and what that's going to look like, what's the moment that kind of sticks with you where you really started to see what this record was going to be?
I work all the time a bit, and I'm in my studio and out of my studio, and I'm collating things, but in a fairly haphazard sort of way. But there does come a point where you think, well, we have enough in the can to make a decision and press that button, say, right, now is the go moment, and we are going to now make a plan and get a team together. And because most of the work was, there's quite a lot of work over a few years on this one, where it's just me on my own in the studio room with a Pro Tools system. And we get to a point where there's a decision, and that requires then a whole series of things that affect each other have to be put into place. You have to decide on who you're going to work with, who producer, studios, musicians. You have to also usually decide on, are you going to tour with it and all that sort of thing. So you have to create a whole timeline that involves all of those things, which very quickly becomes a pressure, a time pressure thing as well as all that.
Sometimes it seems like if you have to think about that stuff, that can kind of take you away from the music. But at the same point, it seems like you're pretty good at maybe keeping the two parts separate.
I think I just say, well, we'll think about that. I probably will do a few dates, but now is the time. I'm not very good at multitasking. I just like to, I put all my focus into one thing, and that seems to work for me.
The way you're playing acoustically with the orchestra building up to the solo on Scattered is pretty stunning. Like, it just generally, that made me wonder how you work out your guitar solos. Is there any one way?
No, there's no one way. And there's no, it's not like I sit down with a piece of paper and have that song in its component parts and say, this will happen. I'm afraid I just sort of let it happen. And, you get to that point and I'm holding the nylon string guitar in my hand and I think, just keep playing. I think that's nice. And it's, don't know if I should admit to it, but it's a lot more haphazard than you'd imagine. They're just the moments for the different things choose themselves and assert themselves onto you.
You know, you mentioned the sample from Joe and yourself that wound up on this record, and, you and Polly have been collaborating for a long time now. I love that this is the album where it really kind of becomes a family affair with Romany, Gabriel, Charlie, Joe added into the mix in various ways. But you can also apply kind of that family spirit to this record as a whole when it comes to the band as well, I think. Like, what do you think that added to the overall spirit of this record? Because it just seemed like you had some really good karma going with this record.
Yeah, the family thing is one issue, and that really came out of the COVID experience and the locking down, where I was together with my family a lot more, and we and the topics of these pandemic type illnesses that at the beginning we thought were going to be really much more dangerous than they eventually turned out to be. And at the same time, Polly's book Theatre for Dreamers was coming out, and that had to, or the some events that we had booked in for promotion of that, to get that known a little bit in the world, had to be cancelled. So Charlie, our son, that we do some live streams too, and we didn't know what that meant at all, but that's what we did. It tied in with Polly's lovely book and doing readings from it and answering questions from people online while that was all going on, was me singing a song or two, usually a cover of a Leonard Cohen song, because Leonard appears in Polly's book to some extent. And I had Romany there with us, and She's been learning the harp, playing it kind of beautifully. It turned out that we were doing these songs with Romany singing harmony with me and playing the harp. And that showed me what we could do together and how the sound of her voice with mine seemed to have something extra to it that is not the usual thing when you get other people singing with you. The Everly Brothers sound pretty good together. Beach Boys. Anyway, there's 100 elements due to the world and time and political situations that led us towards the way this album got made. There's a liberation in there as well, with these live stream things and my daughter being a part of it. And, you know, Polly's been a part of it for 30 something years, 32 years. We've been getting Charlie in to help write some lyrics, and I just felt liberated from any idea of owing something to my past, so that I could just move forward, do something different. And that led on to finding a new, younger producer who was not tied to any of the old ways of thinking, and in fact had no real idea about Pink Floyd and the Pink Floyd career, or me or my solo career, or anything, any of those things. So a lot of elements from this are just starting from a fresh standpoint that I would describe as being liberated in some way. And that's not to say that I'm not full of pride and joy with all the long career and the things that have happened in the past, but my focus is definitely looking forwards.
It's the combination of things. I love that you got Steve Gadd on this record, but at the same point, as you just mentioned, you had a producer that doesn't have it in his head. Here's what Steve Gadd is supposed to sound like. It's an open canvas.
Yeah. Well, I mean, thing about that is that I had, before I got Charlie Andrew on board, I had already booked Steve Gadd. I had some of these tracks, and I wanted to, so I'd managed to book Steve Gadd, and we had a week booked in Mark Knopfler's studio in London, British Grove. In the meantime, Charlie Andrew came along, and Charlie Andrew is a drummer, so as well as being a producer. And so he was as thrilled with the idea of Steve Gadd as I was. But man, he drove Steve Gadd like a tyrant. Steve Gadd was there from dawn till, you know, 10 at night every day, being pushed to do another take and try another thing and do the tambourine and do this and do that. Fantastic. Thrilling.
As a music fan yourself, like, what do you remember about the moment that Steve Gadd kind of came on your radar as a fan?
Surely it must be Chucky's In Love. You know what I'm talking about?
Absolutely.
It's Phil on Chucky's In Love. Now, I think that's the first, but, you know, a lot of Steely Dan, the Paul Simon things, you know. I met Steve Gadd once before with Paul Simon somewhere at a Jules Holland show, I think. Those sort of, the Steve Gadd and Charlie Andrew thing was like a serendipitous addition to everything that Charlie was a drummer and knew all about Steve Gadd, didn't know anything about me.
You're going to play some shows this fall, as you've mentioned, and of course fans are really excited about that. I guess, what are some of the initial thoughts that are in your head about that right now, as far as, you know, to kind of communicate like what we might expect from those shows?
I haven't really got these shows very well worked out yet. I mean, I've got a very loose list of songs and things that I'm expecting to do, which do include one or two from the 70s, which everyone seems to want to know about. I imagine all of this album at maybe in a couple of chunks or something, but we haven't got it that well. It's not quite clear yet. But a lot of the music will be newer. It will be younger than 50 years old.
it's pretty great that you're going to have the Webb sisters as part of your touring group. I mean, obviously, as you've noted, they've worked with Leonard Cohen, but they also sang with Tom Petty on his last tour. Like, they're just such talented singers.
They're brilliant. They're brilliant. And we actually did a first little rehearsal yesterday with just them and Louise Marshall and me at my house, just to see how things might sound. And it was very, very encouraging.
One area that fans are curious about in your catalog that you don't seem to revisit in the live setting is material from the first two solo records. And it made me wonder how you feel about those records now, because there are things obviously like There's No Way Out of Here that, although you didn't write that as an example, stuff like that still receives a good amount of airplay on radio to this day. So I'm curious how you feel about those first two records, because that's where you began solo-wise.
I love those records, both of those two earlier solo records. I've got nothing whatsoever against them, but I listened to the About Face one, and the sound is dated, but that's not overcomable. But some of the topics that are being discussed are also way out of date. And some of the themes aren't quite as universal as you might want to be doing today. And you're right, I haven't played any of them for years, and probably won't this time either. But it's just that thing of they don't sound like me now.
That's been something that's been pretty stunning about listening to this new record, and really like going back to Rattle That Lock and, you know, On an Island and so on, is hearing that journey that you've taken from those first couple records early on to these last three records. Like, you know, what do you see as like your progression?
I just make the record I love these last two ones as well as this one. You know, if one has any regrets about them, I might have upped a tempo or two and made them a bit. I think that they're a bit, you know, possibly a bit too gentle at times. I love them. I love the songs.
I think what I found interesting watching the electronic press kit for this new album is how you've got a lot of gear and pedals that are, you know, often always around you, but it doesn't seem, you know, from what I hear, it doesn't seem like you require much to get your sound.
No, I sound like me, and that is a great positive, but it's inescapable. I can't not sound like me. I've always been a bit of an aficionado for pedals, but I don't like to overuse them. It's true. I'm just bang one in when I want a bit more boost or something, you know. Half the ones I don't even know what they are that I'm using, to be honest. I have a great tech guy, Phil Taylor, who looks after all those things for me and says, try this, try this, try this.
One of the other things that people have always loved about your guitar playing is the economy of your approach. I think you were one of the early people who demonstrated that you can express like so much in your playing without using a lot of notes. Like, what was the moment when you realized that yourself, the fact that less can be more?
When I realized that my fingers were just never going to go much faster. You got to find your own path in this thing. I love making music. I love playing guitar, but to me, it's like I'm playing melodies over a bed of something. You know, while it would be nice to occasionally whiz from one slow, delicate melody to another through a flurry of 36 notes in 10 seconds, in 5 seconds, it's just not really quite me. You know, I do wish I could do it a bit better sometimes. Hey, you know.
I think you've done quite well. Well, I love hearing that you've already kind of got the seeds of another record kind of taking shape in your mind somewhere.
Yeah, I have. That's I will definitely be moving on to that in the new year.
Well, I mentioned that electronic press kit, and one of the things as you were talking about making this record, you talk about how you feel that this is the best album that you've made since Dark Side of the Moon. When did you kind of realize that you felt that way about this record?
When it was finished, you know, and we put it all the songs together in the right order and we're listening to them. You know, I down here in the studio, it's an hour and a bit drive from my house. The record takes 45 minutes. So, you know, we listened to it, me and Polly, a lot, and we still haven't stopped, and we're still as thrilled, and I hear new things in it every time I listen to it. I go, how on earth am I hearing new things in it? I fucking made it. Those things, there's a certain sort of overall magic to it. There's a cohesiveness to it, and a new energy in it that I'm very much liking.
Last couple things from my side. You talk about just the different things that you two felt listening to this. And you know what? Like, after listening to this album a number of times, like, I found myself tearing up, like, listening to things like the words on Sings, like one part of the lyrics in particular. And Behind the Kitchen Shelves, Something's Lost There and Out of Sight, Young Loves, Photographs, Growing Old in Black and White. Now, within the song itself, like, there's this idea that maybe we push the news away and just stay inside the safety of the cocoon together. But there's also the unmistakable feelings of mortality that we are all facing at some point. And you've got a lot of emotions inside the songs on this album, and it just seems like it would have been an emotional thing recording some of these songs.
It is. I love that song. I think Polly was worried it was too sweet, but I tell her it's a work of genius. You know, I am so happy with the way that this record has formed itself, with the way Polly has got herself into my brain and obviously hers, and created subjects that she writes about so beautifully, so poetically, but so eloquently. And they all tie in together. The subject of each song is not the same as the subject of other songs, but, you know, we're not talking concept out there, but we are talking about a cohesion between all the songs that creates something maybe a bit better than all the parts.
Well, David, I think that's a good place to wrap. I really appreciate this record, and I appreciate your time talking about things here.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. Have a good one, David.
Okay, you too, Matt.
We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR Podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.